Welcome to LOA Today. Walt Thiessen and Life Coach Wendy Dillard here. Today is Tuesday, July the 10th, 2018, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, your second daily dose of happy for the day. And we actually got off to a little bit of a late start. That's my fault. I was dealing with other stuff. But we're here. We're ready. We're going. We're having a good time. And we hope you are doing it too. And you're here too. Hooray. How good is that? That's a really good thing. I hope you've been having a good day too. I mean, I kind of assumed it.
I have had a good day.
Because you always do, so that's why I assume it.
Of course.
And actually, it's been a very good day on the other side of the world, too, which is really the topic I wanted to bring up today. I don't know if you've been following it. I've been following it. And it is the good news story of the summer. For those who aren't aware of it, there were 12 boys, Thai boys, who were members of a football team, what we would call a soccer team here in the U.S. And they and their coach had to retreat to a bunch of caves near them when a huge monsoon storm and flooding basically drove them into the caves. And that was around June 23rd, I believe it was. And it just kept... the water kept rising and rising, so they kept retreating farther and farther inside the caves, ultimately got lost, couldn't find where they were anyway, plus the caves were filling up with water. They ended up at a, I guess you might call it a sandbar, deep inside the cave system, and trapped, and not knowing how to get out. And within like a day, of course, everybody realizes, well, where is everybody? So they start raising the alarm, and they come to realize that this group is stuck in the cave system. So now, how do we get them? First of all, how do we find them? And second of all, how do we get them out? And at first, there was a lot of hope about it, but it took almost 10 days for them to be found. And by that time, it had turned into an international rescue effort. In fact, it was two British expert cave divers who were the ones who first found them by going through this very treacherous passage that was about, I think it was a mile and a quarter to a mile and a half long, so like a little over 2 kilometers long. And, I mean, it was just really, really rough to get there. And they finally found them, you know, half emaciated. They got them water. They got them some food. And what followed was days of trying to figure out how to extract them safely. Because they're boys. They're like, you know, ages 12 to 16 or something like that, 11 to 16. None of them were swimmers. None of them had ever done diving, for sure, but they, you know, most of them weren't even adept at just swimming. And the only way out that anybody could find was the way that the two British divers had gotten in, through this long, tortuous, usually in the black, no light at all, half underwater passageway.
And, oh, my God.
And the kids were like, they were becoming emaciated. I mean, they were serious concerns about their health. How the heck were they going to get these kids out? And it became an international thing. Well, the news media, of course, had been covering it, which helped a lot because that brought a lot of international attention. The British sent people to help. The U.S. sent people to help. China, Australia, I mean, a number of different countries sent expert divers and high-tech equipment and all kinds of stuff. Elon Musk, the guy who created the Tesla, invented a little child-sized submarine to send along to them in case that would help them get the kids out. I mean, there were it was this huge, huge effort to get these kids out. Now, of course, the news media, being who they are, they were turning it into, well, there's very little hope for these kids, you know. Nobody's particularly optimistic. I mean, they're doing everything they can, but it's not looking good. And no scenario they can come up with isn't fraught with risk. So they were just building and building and building it. Now, simultaneously, of course, you've got all of the comments that people are posting on social media and the comment sections at the ends of articles and so forth. And when you read those, what you got were kind of what you would expect. A lot of people praying for the boys' safety, praying for a miracle, praying for, you know, some wonderful thing to happen so that they could be rescued. And slowly over time, the team that was at the site pieced together a way to get them out. They ended up figuring out that the best way to do it would be to send two SEALs in. The SEALs they were using was Navy SEALs. These were ex-Navy in Thailand. So these are Thai SEALs. But there were also SEALs from other countries who were there too. There was like well over 100 people who were part of this rescue effort. And they were going to send in two SEALs per child so that... because part of the way through this channel, in order to get through certain places, they had to take their air tanks off and push the air tanks ahead of them So now they had to do that not only for themselves, but also for the child that they were pulling through. So, I mean, it was a really complex operation. Some of the SEALs were commenting, this was the most difficult, complex extraction they had ever heard of.
Wow.
And over the weekend, the biggest threat was that the monsoon rains were going to come and flood the caves, and it's monsoon season. Well, the rains had been holding off, but the forecast was that they were going to start coming in earnest this week. So it was decided this was the last best chance to get them in. They had actually thought about leaving them there until the monsoon season was over, but they eventually gave up on that idea because they didn't think the kids would survive it, even if they were feeding them supplies all the time. So it was a pretty desperate situation. But I kept looking at all that the positive attention that they were getting from just average people, not from the media, but from average people who were just praying for them and pushing for them and, you know, cheering on the Navy SEALs from the various countries and so forth. Well, Saturday they decided to send their first team into. They already had three SEALs and a medic who were staying with them, so they were getting some attention. They were getting food. There were some videos that had come out that, you know, had been shared with their families and so forth. So they were getting some attention, but it was still they needed to get out. So they sent the first team in to extract the first four boys. They decided to do it in groups of four. And the first day they went in, they went through all kinds of training exercises preparing for this. I mean, they basically planned it and executed it as if they were actually going into the system after these boys, so they could make sure they covered every single detail possible. And for good reason, early on, while they were trying to get air to them, one of the Navy SEALs had died. He had actually gotten killed because of a lack of oxygen because they hadn't figured out the whole thing perfectly. Well, once they got the whole thing figured out, it was a much better situation. But, I mean, clearly it was kind of touch and go for a bit there. Anyway, they went in to get the first four boys, and they got the first four boys out in time way faster than what they originally thought. It was about 5 hours faster than they thought. And that sounds like, wow, 5 hours, but compared to what? The trip in each direction is about 5 hours. So it's about a 10-hour trip.
Oh, my gosh.
And they cut the trip in half.
And so is the trip, like, when you say the trip, is that like round trip?
Round trip. They cut the round trip in half that first time.
So these kids and the coach that was with them, when they started going into the cave, really traveled.
Yeah,
far.
They were forced. They went in through a separate place. The divers came in through like a right angle to where the team went in. Where the team went in was completely flooded and impassable. There was no way to get to them that way. So they had to come in through this alternate route. And the alternate route was a longer route. It's about twice as long. But anyway,
I'm assuming that they had to somehow swim. Because they're going through water?
Well, not only that, they had to teach them how to scuba dive.
Oh, so they were going through the water like with scuba gear on.
Right.
And this is what was taking 5 hours from the point of where the kids were to the exit.
Not to mention the fact that the kids didn't even know how to swim.
Wow.
So wow. We're going right from swimming to scuba diving, which is a major jump all by itself. So it was a really incredible project. But they got the first boys out. They decided to take out the four healthiest boys and see if they could get them out first. And they got them out in record time. So the next day, Sunday, they said, okay, well, we're going to go for the second group. And they went for the second group of healthiest boys. And they got them out safely. And then early this morning, now they're like 12 or 13 hours ahead of us. So they're currently on tomorrow. But okay. for there this morning, they went in for the third group. And the third group was the group of boys that were weakest, and they got them out too. In fact, when they came out, the boys were so weak, they got carried by stretcher to the helicopter that went to the hospital. I mean, it was just, they were like right on the edge. And then the coach came out last, and then after the coach, then the three SEALs and the medic who remained behind, they actually were the very last ones out. They got everybody out.
Amazing.
Everybody came out. Everybody survived. And I think, like, wow, first of all, what wonderful good news that is. And how rarely do we hear wonderful good news coming out of the media? I mean, there were media people who were saying, I don't get to report this kind of thing very often. This is not normal. This is not the way this usually goes for us. We're usually reporting all the terrible stuff. And then he went in to report the terrible stuff. But nevertheless, he mentioned that part.
And now for some more terrible stuff,
right? Because we got to make sure that we're keeping you really scared, right? So, yeah, but that was just like an amazing piece of good news. And when good news like that comes along, I really believe firmly that we have to celebrate it and we have to dwell on it because, boy, I mean, that's how we get into alignment, right? By focusing on the good stuff. Well, here we got some great stuff to focus on. And what's the typical reaction for most people, particularly those who don't know Law of Attraction? Wow, that's great. Okay, let's get on with the day. They don't spend any time celebrating it, which is a loss. I mean, here's a terrific thing to get excited about. So I think we should spend as much time as possible getting excited about it and feeling good about it. Now, the other part, and this is the part I really wanted to talk about today, is one of the headlines. I can't remember exactly what the headline was, but the news reporters had been talking about not only what the scientific efforts were to extract them, but also spiritual practices. Like the boys are Buddhists, so they practice Buddhist meditation in order to stay calm while they're waiting for the 17-day period to end. You know, so that was pretty wild. And there were also, there were like Buddhist monks who had led special prayers to open the mouth of the cave to help the kids escape and so forth, and a number of other modalities at work here. And the one modality, of course, that didn't get any attention because it was never considered, I'm sure, was the Law of Attraction. So I want to know, what role did the Law of Attraction play? Or more precisely, I want to explore what role the Law of Attraction played, because I think it probably played a pretty big role in this.
Well, are you wanting to start from the beginning, like how they got in there, or are you wanting to start at the end and go backwards?
We can go either direction. I mean,
okay. Well,
which way do you want to go?
This is a story that you have followed.
Okay.
My only knowledge of it really was the few times you've mentioned it on the podcast, and then you sent me a link today, which I read through, but it really didn't have a whole lot of juiciness to it. It was just kind of a dry read. So I'm curious as to, like, What do you see in terms of Law of Attraction? What's your first take on it?
Well, I think the most obvious example of how Law of Attraction was involved was in the public reaction overall to the scenario, to the event that was going on. Because first of all, you have the media reaction, but second of all, you have the public reaction. And the media reaction was predictably negative. The public reaction, if we were to analyze it from, say, the point of view of Abraham's Astonishing Power of Emotions book, we would describe most of the comments left by the public as being downstream comments. The media were, they were all publishing on the upstream comments. They were talking about all the things that could go wrong.
That listeners are all on the same page. Downstream is when things are going with ease and flow, just like when a river is flowing downstream, it just goes naturally, where upstream requires a lot of effort and has resistance because you're going against the current.
Exactly. Okay. And this is actually a much more common occurrence than people might realize. I mean, the media, you can count on them to always look for the worst possible scenario. So they are not just upstream, they are paddling furiously with, you know, a diesel engine pushing them along. That's how hard they're going upstream at all times. But there are not all stories, I would say probably the majority don't fall in this category, but there are a minority of stories where you look at what public comments are, and there's more downstream than upstream. There's more positive than negative. There's more hope than hopelessness, which is interesting. And it's actually, for me, very hopeful. It tells me that despite the negative impact that the media have on people, there are a lot of people who, even if they don't know anything about the Law of Attraction, they're still putting themselves into a better feeling place, probably out of habit, probably because they're just, the people who do that are probably more positively oriented anyway, you know? So I think that's really what happens with them. But particularly with this story, there were a whole lot of them, a whole lot of people publishing a whole lot of very positive, hopeful, prayerful, expectant comments saying, essentially, they were trying to come up with their own ideas about how to extract the boys, you know, how to get them food. I mean, all this, these ideas were popping forth from people, and they were all predominantly in the downstream mode.
And we have seen over the years many crisis-type situations that absolutely draw the best out of people. I truly believe that people, all people, desire well-being, even if they don't know it, because all individuals are connected to an inner being, the non-physical part of themselves, and the non-physical part of all of us knows that well-being is the law of the land.
True.
And so I believe that this taps into the sense of well-being that we all innately connect to on some level. And it brings out our hopefulness. It brings out our best. It brings out the desire for compassion. It brings out the, what can I do to help? You know, I mean, the man who, you know, the Navy SEAL that died in the process of this, that's one of the things that stood out to me, is that he gave his life so that others may live.
Right.
And I don't call that a sacrifice. I call that a choice. And I do, I'm on the same page with Abraham that all death is choice. All death, they even say, go so far as to say suicide to make a point. But that man, I truly believe, knew that he was going in to make a difference, and this would his, be his last effort on this planet, you know, in this lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like that truly is coming from a state of well-being, not even fearing for own, his own life, but going in and doing what he felt was the right thing to do. And I love knowing that crisis brings the best out of people. I don't love that we have crisis, but I do know that crisis brings the best out in all of us.
And I'm sure that if he were still alive and being interviewed, he'd agree with you. He'd say, yeah, absolutely. I went in there because it was more important to me to save their lives than it was for me to keep my own. I'm sure he would say that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we saw the best of people during 9/11. The best of people coming out during Hurricane Katrina, the best of people, I don't remember the name of the tsunami that happened overseas, but it's like, and then the hurricanes that happened last year in Texas and in Cuba, it's like truly the best of people shows up, you know, and I almost wonder if when people come to that point of like crisis situation, it's like now it's a matter of survival. For some, it's survival, and for some, it's just this huge sense of what can I do to make a difference. It's like resistance just falls away. You know, I mean, the firefighters that go off and fight every single day, wildfires in our country because of the drought season.
Right.
You know, every day they're facing potential fear, but they're doing what they do, and I don't believe they walk into it with resistance. If they did, they would probably all come out dead.
Or yeah, right.
Come out at all.
Right, exactly.
You know, but it's like resistance is gone. And who knows? Maybe crisis is the thing that causes us to drop our resistance. I mean, that would be an interesting idea to explore.
Well, I certainly think that this is based on my conversations with Joel, because this is a big Joel theme, that struggle is certainly, people who go through major struggles are the people who usually turn those struggles into springboards to tremendous growth in their own lives, and tremendous results that come later on that were totally unexpected. And it's because they went through difficult struggles earlier on. So I think there's definitely that part of it. And I think you're right. I think there is less resistance. I mean, I don't think that any of the people really think, you know, I'm going to lower my resistance. I don't think that's what's going on. But nevertheless, there's something about, you know, dealing with an imminent emergency, an imminent danger that leads people to do their best in a way that they don't necessarily do the rest of the day or the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
But for that one period of time, boom, they're in their best mode.
And I remember, I don't remember if it was 9/11 or Katrina, but one of the disasters, you know, where people meaning media, they were conversing, and not a negative, not a positive. They were just in conversation. You know how they're, because they're on the air for hours and hours, and they just
got to fill the airtime.
Air. So it's like they're conversing, and they were talking about, this is what I remember, how, you know, people were so rallying in a positive way to bring about really incredible results. And they were commenting on how wonderful it was that this happened. And then simultaneously saying, and I wonder how long this will last. And I didn't see that as like a negative comment. I saw that as a pretty like natural comment. Like, you know, people are going to show their best today, but eventually the major crisis part will have come to an end. And when it comes to rebuilding the city, rebuilding the lives, you know, rebuilding. And then people go back into, well, now I have to go back to my job, and now I have to go back into every day. And now the petty little things all of a sudden become, you know, like the big deal of the day, when just a week ago, people's lives were hanging by a thread, you know, and now somebody is stuck in traffic and they're complaining.
Yeah.
And it is an interesting dichotomy.
It is.
You know, of like what we consider life and death versus, you know, it's a traffic light. But sometimes we treat a traffic light like our life is hanging in the balance.
That is true also.
You know.
Yeah.
And I truly believe it's all a choice.
It is.
We're not always conscious of the choice, and we're not always having the choice, you know, in front of us where we go, oh, I have a choice. I can either be upset or I can be happy. It's kind of like an autopilot thing that we just do. And it's not until we become really aware that we do have choice that we actually start to use our choice.
I also think that one of the really cool and interesting pieces of information that comes out of a story like this is the realization of how our individual perspectives shift. They shift with circumstances. And most of the time we don't notice it. But clearly the perspectives of the rescue team, their perspective changed dramatically as a result of this. I mean, one day they were living their lives. The next day, all of a sudden, boom, they're on this site trying to figure out how to extract 12 boys and their coach from deep inside a cavern system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you go into a situation like that, it's got to change your perspective. You just see things differently. You just experience things differently. How many people who are rescuers talk later about how they didn't think? It wasn't that, like, there was a thought. There was just one thing, and they just knew that's where they had to go. And I guarantee you, that's not the way they live their lives. That's what they did during the emergency. But that's not how they live their lives day to day. It's not like, I got to have that donut. I got to have this. I got to have that. That's not what they're doing. But when the emergency hits, bang, I got to go. I just got to go do this.
Yeah, big events like this have such a huge impact on those that are intricately involved. It can't not change a life.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, I've never been in this kind of a life or death situation, but to me, a big event that happened to me was when I was in Russia in 1993. I was there with a theatrical group.
Mm-hmm.
We were there for 4.5 weeks. And this was right after Perestroika, which is when Russia went from the Soviet Union communism to Russia, which was now more of a democracy. It just wasn't communist anymore.
Right.
But the people were, I was there 3 years after that big change in their government happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to witness, because I was, for 4.5 weeks, I was there amongst people. And I had an interpreter who was with me. And so she was Russian. And she was with me quite often. So I got to really get to know her. And she talked about her family and about their government and what things were like. And I'll tell you, that trip changed my life.
I'm sure.
Because I saw firsthand how people lived that weren't Americans.
Right.
And I took for granted the freedoms that I have as an American in a way that, like, so here's the story. So the interpreter, she was an only child, and her parents both worked for the government. And so part of that meant that they were kind of in a good position because they had a steady stream of funds, but it was meager
right,
funds.
Right.
And they had to live by very stringent rules. And so it's kind of like if her father or mother did anything that was out of line, they could be thrown in prison forever. And so they lived very rigid lives and they lived in fear. And as I heard her, I could just feel the bleakness of the life that she must have lived. And she said that her parents' goal, their entire goal in life, everything they worked for was to get her educated so she could leave Russia. That was their entire goal.
Yeah.
And I said, well, what's the plan for you to leave? She said, well, I'm an interpreter. And she said, now I'm learning Swedish. And once I get, you know, Swedish so that I really understand it, my hope is that I can transfer or I can move to Sweden and be employed there as an interpreter because I would speak Russian, English, and Swedish.
Mm.
And I couldn't imagine what it would be like knowing that her whole life she was being geared to leave her family, the only family she knew.
Yeah.
And that was considered a good luck story.
Right.
And when I came home, I mean, I literally, and I did it on purpose, I literally kissed the floor of the DFW airport when I got on the other side of customs as a symbol of my gratefulness to be here in America.
Mm.
And I don't take my freedom lightly. It changed me forever. And even when I hear, because you and I have talked a little teeny bit about politics, because I know that was a major thing for you, and how I've talked about, I really don't get involved in politics.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that is because I so loved my freedom, and I just adore it, that I don't want to get in the muck and the mire and persuaded by other people that don't understand freedom the way I do.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You know, and so I stay on the side of, you know what, I'm not going to get myself overly involved, and I'm going to come from a position of pure positive energy that I know well-being is the law of the land and freedom is ours in America.
Mm.
And I believe it will continue to be ours, at least through my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm. But it's like that to me, going to Russia was a life event that changed my life.
So you were actually in Russia about 6 years after Billy Joel was. Did you ever see that video?
No.
Billy Joel made a video, or had somebody make a video, while he made his historic trip doing a concert series in Russia in 1987, just before the wall came down. The wall came down 2 or 3 years later. And he was invited by Gorbachev, because that was the only way he could ever get in. They weren't going to let him in otherwise. But he was invited to do this tour because Gorbachev recognized... first of all, Gorbachev loved rock and roll, which was really helpful. And second of all, Gorbachev recognized the winds of change, and he knew that if his country was going to survive, it had to change. It had to transition to the system that Boris Yeltsin ultimately, you know, led the way on. But it was Gorbachev who pre-paved it, and did so pretty much fighting the hardliners every step of the way. Well, anyway, long story short, he got Billy Joel in there, and they made this video of what happened during that trip. I think the video is called A Matter of Trust. Really good one. I thoroughly recommend that you see it sometime. But they talked about a number of the things that you were talking about there, about, you know, the fear, about how, like, for instance, when they did their first concert, the first concert that they did was actually not a concert, not by design, by them anyway. It was, I don't know exactly where it was. I think it was in southern Russia. And it was at a TV station, and it was right after they had spent time with some monks up in the mountains who liked to sing a cappella choruses together. And so, you know, Billy Joel with his group, they were sharing back and forth what kinds of songs they sang a cappella. So they had fun with that. And then they went to do this news program, and they were asked to play on this program. Oh, no, I'm sorry, it wasn't a news program. It was in an auditorium. And all they had was a piano there, so it wasn't like his whole band or anything like that. He thought he was just going to go in there and talk to the audience, maybe play a song or two, and that was about it. Well, they wanted it to be a full concert, and he wasn't ready for that. So basically, you had this audience largely full of kids who were so eager to hear this American artist. They didn't even know who he was. Most people in Russia had no idea who Billy Joel was. But they'd heard that he was the big... you know, American rock star, and they really wanted to hear him play. And he actually ripped up his voice because he didn't have the proper audio system to play into. Well, then he had to go do the real first concert, and the real first concert was in front of all of the elite of the Communist Party, who were against what he was doing.
Lovely.
But this is like going to the concert, right? This is like you know, the elite of the elite going to the best event, and of course they got all the front row seats and everything. And so they start playing their show for the first, you know, the very first concert. And as he's watching his audience, he's thinking to himself, we're dead. Because there's no reaction. You can see some of them, they're covering their ears with their hands because the music is so loud. And he's saying, we're dead. This is going to be like the worst disaster of all time. And he had put his own money into this tour. He put something like $3 or $4 million dollars of his own money into this tour. You know, so he thought he was an absolute catastrophe about to happen. Well, by the time of, I don't know if like the first few songs were done or if there was a break or what, the intelligentsia, you know, the elite, got up and left. And as they left, they gave their tickets to all the kids who were outside. And one of the most famous parts of this video is Billy going to the back of the hall where all the kids were, carrying just a portable mic while he's singing and his band is playing, and like the Pied Piper, slowly leading them up to the front of the amphitheater so he could have all his fans up front.
Oh my goodness.
But I mean they would do things like they would shine lights on the audience and the audience would freeze. Now why did they want to shine lights on the audience? They wanted to show it as part of the video. But the audience would freeze because they were so afraid that they were on camera that, you know, they'd get in trouble for something. And then the lights would go off and they'd start dancing around again.
Well, you know, I mean, I am very sensitive to energy. And I didn't know this back in 93, how sensitive I was to energy. But I felt the emotional pulse of Moscow. Mm. That's where I was.
Yeah.
I felt the pulse. And our theatrical group performed in the Kremlin State Palace.
Ah.
Behind the Kremlin wall. I mean, I was in some of the most sacred, you know, places ever. And I, you know, talked with or smiled and did a lot of charades. I couldn't really speak to them. To the people who, you know, operated the Kremlin State Palace.
Mm.
They called them babushka ladies, literally older women who wore scarves on their heads.
Right.
You know, they were like the janitorial staff, but they were also like security.
Mm.
And they took their jobs very seriously. But the expressions on these people were so somber. And I remember walking past this one babushka lady every single day and smiling at her and saying, Das Badanya, which mm-hmm. I think meant good morning. And she would look at me with this scowl, like, how dare you speak to me and why are you bothering kind mm-hmm. of thing. And I just did it every single day with the intention of bringing some joy to this woman's life. And after a couple weeks, I could see the corners of her mouth just begin to crack. Like she wanted to smile, but she dared not to.
Right.
And eventually she smiled. And I remember by the end of my trip, I held her hand and hugged her. And she warmly received my embrace. But oh my gosh, I just recognized the conditioning that the people of Russia lived in because of years and years and years worth of indoctrination. Just like we're indoctrinated in what we believe.
Oh, yeah.
But they were indoctrinated in their beliefs. And now all of a sudden they're being told, okay, you're free. No, they weren't.
They didn't know how to be.
Maybe the laws said they were free, but they were still imprisoned in their mind.
Right.
And it was just like, oh, my goodness. And I actually had to go back 2 years later. We did another theatrical tour there, same place. And this one was only for 10 days. And I was grateful it was only 10 days because I thought the first time it was so long and it just it permeated through my being. I could feel the heartbeat of these people and their sadness. And more than sadness, it was despair, you know.
Yeah.
And what was fascinating is one day we weren't doing a show. And so we kind of got to do whatever we wanted. And it was freezing cold. It was March and, you know, it was freezing. But, you know, I like the cold, so it was all right. Anyway, I'm walking along this in front of the Kremlin State Palace, in front of the Kremlin wall. There's this huge park. And I was walking along the park and there was a street artist and he was selling his art. And I looked at this painting. It absolutely captured my attention. It was in beautiful hues of oranges and greens and yellows. And it was like a garden scene. And through my charades, I asked him what this was a picture of. And through his charades, he let me know it was this very place we were standing in the spring.
Oh.
And I bought the painting. I have framed it. I look at it every day in my office. But why I believe it meant so much to me is because it told me that the winter, and I meant this metaphorically, the winter of their despair was going to bloom and they would shift through that. And that was kind of the energetic gap that I was standing in on behalf of this man and these people. Not that I have the power to do everything, but what I knew to do was to stand in hope for them that they would be able to shift their thinking from despair to hope. And this picture of springtime with the blossoms opening up represented that to me. And it, you know, some people are like, well, you were there in the winter. How come you bought a picture of the spring or summer? And I said, for this very reason. And in my little way, I believe I've had something to do with helping those people move through what they were in.
Oh, I'm sure.
It touched me so deeply, and I was hoping that I could give back to them because, like I said, it was an event that changed my life.
Oh, I'm sure you had an effect. I'm sure you had a big effect. That was one of the themes in Billy Joel's movie, the one that was called A Matter of Trust. That's why it was called A Matter of Trust. Because it started off with all the distrust between his band and the intelligentsia, you know, the elite of the Communist Party, and then got replaced with how he basically got the kids to warm up to him. You know, the young people warmed up to him, and they started getting excited, and they started daring to dance a little bit, and then they got more and more excited, and they danced some more. And part of what he did, of course, you know, they don't speak English. He didn't speak Russian, so he had his own translator, who was a really cool translator, really good guy. He refused to accept the one that the Soviet government gave him. He got one that was like an alternate translator. And the way he described it is this guy lived a really rough existence because if you're not official, trying to survive is really difficult, even for a translator. But had this great translator. And there's one scene where he's talking to the audience and he's basically explaining what the next song is all about. And the song is his song, A Matter of Trust. And he's describing the song. He's explaining what the song is about. And you could just see the audience. They weren't moving, but it was as if their attention was moving closer and closer. They were so enthralled by what he was saying. And as the translator who was interviewed after the fact explained, the reason it worked so well is that Billy wasn't pulling the wool over their eyes. He was just telling them the way things were, the way it was. His honesty was incredible. And in fact, he also did the song Honesty. And honesty, of course, had a whole new meaning there because now they're getting honest communication going on. So by the end of this concert tour, I mean, they had like reams of friends, huge numbers of friends that they didn't even know that they'd had before, just because of all these connections that he made. And in fact, the person that they focused on, a Russian who was a member of the Moscow Circus, who they had run into early on because they wanted to give their daughter something to do. Her daughter was like, I don't know, 3 or 4 years old at the time, something like that. And ultimately, she's the one, by the way, when she grew up, she's the one who actually finished putting the film together, interestingly enough. Wow. But she was very young at the time, and they wanted to give her something to do. So they took her to the Moscow Circus while the circus was doing their rehearsals. And so the performers, they brought around a small pony, and they let her ride on the pony, and she was so excited. You know, there's all this kind of stuff going on like that. Well, in the course of that, Billy and his wife, of course, we all know who his wife at the time was. She's a pretty famous person herself. The two of them were talking with these twins who were clowns in the circus. And one of them, his name was Victor, he and Billy created this tremendous connection between the two of them. So that by the time Billy had to leave, I mean, they were practically in tears that they were never going to see each other again. In fact, the song that Billy Joel wrote called Leningrad is about this guy. Mm. And this guy, when he got to all the concerts, which is really remarkable by itself. Because as you know, it wasn't easy to get around. It was much harder to get around before the wall came down. It was easier afterward. Before, it was almost impossible to get around from city to city. And yet, this guy managed to follow him to all the concerts, and he was always up front, yay, just having a good time. So it just led to this wonderful sub-storyline between him and Billy. And just the whole movie was about building trust and how the trust led to an empowerment of the people. It was just amazing.
Which really kind of takes us back to the story of the day.
Yeah.
It really is about trust. I mean, those 13 people, 12 kids and a coach, had to trust. Whether they trusted their spiritual beings or whether they trusted humanity, they had to have some kind of trust to pull themselves out.
Exactly. Yeah.
And their loved ones who are on the other side, not having any idea where they are, they all had to have trust that somehow, some way, they were going to see their loved ones again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like, it really, I mean, think about the just extraneous circumstances that they had to go through in order to even pull off the rescue. Every single act that they did was a trust act of, well, we came up with this idea, but will it work?
Right.
You know, a lot of trust was going on. And, you know, how does the law of attraction fit into this? Well, law of attraction is responding to every feeling that we have. And when there are feelings that are united together with a commonality, the power and the intensification of that broadcast signal becomes huge.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know, and the more people that were putting aside their differences and putting aside their resistances on, you know, the fight they had with their spouse that morning, because now they had a rescue mission. It's like they became unified in their mission. And that level of unification is a broadcast signal that I believe is so incredibly huge,
mm-hmm.
that law of attraction responds to. And I believe that's why we see the incredible rescues that we see, or we see the bonding after a big crisis. There's just things going on that, from a universal perspective, are being amplified, because it's not just one individual.
Yes.
It's countless individuals all focused in a very similar fashion. And law of attraction has something really powerful to respond to. And the response is always in equal degree to that which the energy is being sent.
Which is a very powerful amplification method, as it turns out.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
In fact, one of the things that I noticed, well, there are two things that I noticed. First, there were historical overtones here that the media kind of ignored. But, you know, you look back, say, 50, 60, 70 years ago, it used to be known as French Indochina. And there was also a tremendous British presence even before that, colonial presences. And who is it who finds this group of boys? Two British divers. I mean, the symbolism there was just incredible. Because the country that used to be one of the invaders who were trying to colonize Southeast Asia was the country that sent the divers to help save these local boys. That was, I mean, the media missed that one entirely, but I saw that and I said, whoa. I mean, that's just laden with symbolism. And then the other thing that I noticed, and this is more of my personal experience of it. Now, I'm like 90,000 miles away. You know, I have no connection to it at all other than what I'm seeing in the news. And yet, I got to tell you, Wendy, from the moment that I heard about what was going on and I saw what was going on, I had absolutely no doubt at all they were going to get out. None. I mean, I was 100% sure. And if you had asked me how I knew, I would have said, I don't know. I really had no idea how, but I mean, just deep down, I felt like, yeah, they're going to get out.
There's trust.
Yeah, real big trust. Now, again, easy to trust. I'm 90,000 miles away, but nevertheless, I don't know what it was. It was a certainty. It was just a certainty inside me, like, yes. And I think part of it was because of all of the positive commentary I was seeing. I knew, because of what we talk about every day, I knew that all that positive commentary was so downstream and so aligning that it had to produce some really, really good results, which it did.
It's an amazing story, and I have a feeling that at least for the next couple of days, because that's about all any big event gets, at least for the next couple of days, there'll probably be more stories and more thoughts and insights as to what occurred.
Oh, yeah. There was also, there's a kind of a fun, positive little story that goes along with it. And you got to bear with me here because I have to go look it up. I got to make sure I get the right word. It's not that. But apparently the rescue team, which is mostly Thais, although there was also a whole bunch of international presence as well, they adopted a little catchphrase used by sailors in the U.S. Navy to describe jubilation. And I'm trying to find where the exact word is. I'm doing a little lookup while we're doing this. I think it's like hoo-yah or something like that. I'm trying to find the exact phrase. And I'm not finding it. But whatever it was, they adopted that as their hashtag for the operation.
Oh.
And I'm thinking, if you adopt that as a hashtag, what does that say about your mindset? That says you're just positive. You're just flowing. You are flowing with source energy. And of course, that when they finally got all the kids out, that's what they tweeted out. That was the message.
Oh,
like,
that's
yeah,
cool.
We got them. Yahoo! Except it wasn't
really
Yahoo.
Cool.
It was like Hoo-yah or whatever it was. whatever the phrase. But I mean, how cool is that? Now, again, that's not something that got a whole lot of attention. Yeah, Hooyah, that's what it is. H-O-O-Y-A-H. I finally found it.
Well, isn't that a like a military?
Yeah, it's used in the U.S. Navy. That's where they got it from.
Okay.
According to this definition, it's used to build morale and it signifies verbal acknowledgement. But it's supposedly it's a morale builder. It's like, yeah, all right, let's go. Like when you have the teams huddling up before the next play and they slap high five or everybody puts their hand in the middle. Oh, yeah, let's go. That kind of thing. Hooyah.
That will be your new favorite phrase.
Hooyah. Yeah, it's my favorite phrase of the day. My favorite word. So, yeah, I've adopted hooyah. But law of attraction, cool. Law of attraction is laced throughout all of this entire event. The whole thing is just laden with law of attraction. It's laden with what happens when predominant mindsets prevail, because that's exactly what happened. And interestingly enough, when it came to the point where they knew that the first eight were out, and now it was just a question, could they get the last four plus the coach? And the last four plus the coach came out. The reports are that all of the team were celebrating. They were doing dances. They were jumping up and down and so forth. And the media were separated. They put up like screens to block everybody. But the media caught wind of it when the kids were being wheeled by ambulance to a helipad. So that's when they knew that everybody's out. And when they saw that, the media started to applaud. The media even got excited. So the negatarians were the ones who joined the celebration. I'm thinking, wow, how cool is that?
Well, I have to say, as far as the media goes, we talk about the media in a negative way when we lump them together. But the media is made up of individuals.
True.
And I still believe that individuals all believe in the best of humanity, even if their job is to report in a way where they're given a script that it's negative. It's like they're still individuals. They still have families. They still, wish the best for all of us. So I don't see it as like, oh, wow, and even the media. What I see is they're just people. In that moment, they're not the media. They're just people. They're just the part of the human race.
And what I'm seeing, I agree with you. What I see beyond that, though, is they broke through the script. You mentioned the script, and they do. They have a script that they're working to. I mean, that's how they get paid. They get paid based on the advertising. And that advertising depends on feeding the fear-driven stuff. But like you say, they're also human beings, and as human beings, they celebrate a thing, and they broke through the script that day to really celebrate. That I wasn't seeing that as a negative. I was seeing it as a tremendous plus, like fantastic. They put the script aside and said, whoa, this is a great thing. I love it. So that's why I was looking at it. We got about 5 minutes left. Before I want to get back to what you're saying, but I also want to make sure I get this in.
We actually have 15 minutes because we started late.
Oh, you're right. Well, yeah, actually, it's about 12 minutes. You're right. But I still want to get this in because I do want to make sure I get this in. We've been encouraging people to subscribe if they have not yet been subscribers. And this is one episode I want to make sure I get that message out, because our regular subscribers, and they are numerous, are getting this along with every other episode that comes to their smartphones automatically. If you're a new subscriber new listener, and you are not yet subscribed and you're liking this kind of content, we want to encourage you to subscribe now. It's free. It doesn't take any time hardly at all. It takes about a minute. Certainly a lot less time than trying to extract 12 boys and a coach from a cave. It's so quick. You go to the homepage at loatoday.net. The instructions are right there. About a minute later, you're subscribed. And then you're going to get episode after episode after episode of high quality, positive, enthusiastic, really energy-raising stuff coming to your phone every single day that you can listen to anytime you want to during the day. So please do take a moment and subscribe and do yourself the favor of feeding yourself that daily dose of happy that we all really need. I just want to get that in. So go ahead, Wendy. I didn't mean to cut you off, but I just had to get that in.
Oh, that's okay. I just felt like after you said that, I should say amen. Actually, because we've been talking a little bit about the media, the thought has come to me before, but I think I'm going to say it here. I would like to be a part of shifting the perception of our media to one of they are all individuals that have love at the core, just like you and I do. and that we don't have to look upon the media in a negative way unless we choose to.
Okay.
And it's really our choice if we demonize them versus just let them be people who have a job. And so I'm just thinking in this moment, you know, I'm making my own conscious choice that people who are part of the media are just individuals like me who have a job, but that they're not bad. And even if they read news that is of a negative nature, that doesn't make them bad. It just meant that they read news that to me was not maybe the way I would want to perceive that situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think we could be a part of making a change, and we can do that with choice because we do have choice as to how we view everything.
Well, strictly speaking, you and I are part of the media. I mean, we're doing a podcast that is media.
I never thought about it.
I mean, we really are. We're part of the media. Now, we're not doing newscasts. Okay. Not generally, anyway. Today we're doing a bit of a newscast, but not normally. Normally we're not doing like, here's what happened in the news. But nevertheless, we're still part of the media.
Okay. I hadn't thought about that. But I know I'm a human being with positive intent, and so I don't see myself, in other words, when I think of the media, to me the media is generally demonized. They're usually lumped together in a group of people who are naysayers. And whether I'm part of that or not part of that, I want to make a choice, a deliberate choice, to no longer demonize them and to not set them apart from me, but recognize I am a part of them. And now you made it even more clear, if we're doing a podcast, we are media, but that I am one of them and I have a positive idea intent. That my intent is a positive idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good point. And in fact, I would even take it another step by saying any news item, no matter what it is a news item by itself. And it has nothing to do with the messenger who's delivering it. That's really what your point is. It really isn't the message. Yeah. It's the messages themselves are negative. The messenger isn't necessarily negative. The messenger is just the guy carrying the message. And so I think it's a really good idea to separate the messenger from the message in our heads. By the same token, if I see a message I don't like, I'm still not going to like the message. But I think I'm going to keep in mind what you're saying. Yeah, I don't really want to demonize the messenger. It's not like the messenger is, you know, Satan incarnate. I don't really believe that.
Well,
so.
And I know I was talking about this yesterday about practicing and kind of stretching our ability to find different ways to look at things. I do that sometimes if I'm in the dentist's office and they have the TV on and I have nothing else to stare at, I stare at the TV, and even though they have it on mute, I see the little captions.
Oh, of course.
At the bottom. And so I'm seeing all this news, and sometimes I use that as an opportunity to stretch myself and see how good I am at reframing the meaning that is given to things, because it might say something like, you know, terrorist plot discovered in such and such country, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I look at that and went, okay, terrorist plot has been discovered. Well, what if I don't call it a terrorist plot? What if I just call it a group of people had an idea, an extreme idea? What if I change that to a whole bunch of individuals got together and they were bouncing around some thoughts? They were brainstorming. Now, whether this is true or not doesn't matter, but this is how I take things apart and try to find different ways to look at it.
And I need you to expand on that for a moment, because you just made a really important comment. Whether or not it's true is not important. Talk about that.
Well, when I'm watching these little news clips running along the bottom of the TV, and I'm using those clips as a way to exercise my ability to reframe concepts and ideas, it doesn't matter whether my ideas are accurate or not in the moment relative to what's actually going across the screen. Mm-hmm. I'm just using it as an exercise. In other words, it would behoove every individual on the planet to learn how to give different meaning to things than what our typical meaning is.
And so, why does it behoove somebody? Why is that a good thing?
Because in the world of law of attraction, if you spend the majority of your time focused on negative things, because the only way you look at them is, oh, but it's bad, then you end up feeling kind of stuck and stagnant in that perception.
Oh, yeah.
But the way, you know, law of attraction responds is to whatever you're feeling. Well, if you're constantly broadcasting a negative signal because the only way you see certain things is through a negative lens, that's what you keep getting back, more of it. But if you can begin to shift the exact circumstances that have been happening to you over and over and start to see them through a different lens or a different perception, it will shift your feelings about how you feel about that situation. And then law of attraction will have something different, a new feeling from which to respond. So like the example I had, I went from because the news called it a terrorist group, I looked for a new way to look at that. And I said, maybe instead of a terrorist group, it's a group of individuals. Well, how I think about a group of individuals versus how I think about terrorists have two different feelings. Because the thought of terrorists caused me to feel a little bit negative. It causes me to feel fear, a little bit vulnerable. But if I just think of a group of individuals, well, I've been a part of a group of individuals. And being a part of a group of individuals is not scary to me.
And your purpose here isn't so much what they really are. It's how you decide to look at groups of people.
And not even a group of people. It's how do I feel when I begin to shift the wording?
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to change the meaning that I'm giving to something. Because when I give something a meaning, I usually get there will be an associated feeling.
But my point is, you're doing this for you. You're doing this to help you with your perception.
Yes, I'm calling it an exercise.
Mm-hmm, right.
I'm not trying to change the news.
Right.
I'm just saying when I am faced with the news, instead of being indoctrinated by it and then going, oh, this feels so bad, I hate the news. Okay, I'm going to use this as an educational exercise. And I'm going to see if I can find just a different way to view this idea. This thing that the media is slanting one way. Let's see if I can slant it another way.
You're kind of doing with the news what I was doing when I was dealing with my knee pain a few weeks back. I was dealing with this chronic pain. It was on my mind. And I was trying to refocus myself away from that onto what I would prefer instead, or at least on something that would feel better instead, trying to change my perspective. I mean, you aren't in pain as you're watching the newscast, but nevertheless, you're dealing with something that we're inundated by, and you're deciding, you know what, I'm not going to let that inundation control my perspective. I'm going to control my perspective, and I'm going to start changing it.
Correct. And I mean, I've worked with clients where I'm, like one client in particular, I'm working with her to help her understand how she assesses the meaning for things. Because some of us think that a meaning is absolute. That if it's a terrorist, it's bad. If it's a sunny day, it's good. Those are like absolutes. Those are like the predominant given meaning that the majority of individuals would agree that's what something means. Well, you could say the word heart attack to me and say, Wendy, does it have a positive connotation or negative? And I might be thinking about my previous business partner, Steve, and I'll say positive. Really? Why would you think a heart attack is positive? Because that heart attack changed his life.
Mm-hmm.
He finally got out of his own negative way and realized that life was worth living, and he wanted to really become who he was meant to be instead of being this really dull, unpleasant, unhappy, mean, angry version of himself.
And
for him, the heart attack was the best thing that could have ever happened to him.
And on that note, we got to draw a close because we're running out of time. But that was a great analogy to bring up. And I hope maybe we can continue that conversation tomorrow because it was really a good one. Wendy, it's been a pleasure. Let's talk again tomorrow.
Okay. We'll be here.
And we'll see you all next time as well here on LOA Today. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye-bye for now.